Today is Tuesday, August 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, U.S. President Donald Trump announced a new preliminary trade deal with Mexico.
It's an incredible deal. It's an incredible deal for both parties. Most importantly, it's an incredible deal for the workers and for the citizens of both countries.
Plus, investigators said that Myanmar's military leaders should be prosecuted for genocide. And should people take low doses of aspirin to prevent heart attacks? We have that answer. It's all ahead on today's International Edition. U.S. President Donald Trump said on Monday that the United States and Mexico have reached a trade agreement, leaving Canada as the odd man out in efforts to revise or replace the North American Free Trade Agreement known as NAFTA.
This is something that's very special for our manufacturers and for our farmers from both countries, for all of the people that work for jobs. It's also great trade, and it makes it a much more fair bill. And we are very, very excited about it. We have worked long and hard. Your representatives have been terrific. My representatives have been fantastic, too. They've gotten along very well, and they've worked late into the night for months. It's an extremely complex bill, and it's something that I think will be talked about for many years to come. Just good for both countries. As far as Canada is concerned, we haven't started with Canada yet. We wanted to do Mexico and see if that was possible to do.
Joining me on the phone is VOA's White House Bureau Chief, Steve Herman. Steve, the president has called this an extremely complex bill, but good for farmers in both countries, and it will make great trade. But what do we know about this new United States-Mexico trade agreement?
Well, we know a bit about it. There are adjustments and concessions by both the United States and Mexico, especially when it comes to the automotive industry. The president's also saying that there's going to be more U.S. Agricultural products purchased by Mexico effective immediately. Now, as we know, the president frequently engages in hyperbole and tends to oversimplify details. As you note, it's a complex deal, and it was quite a battle over extended negotiations to get to this point. And really, what we're looking at this particular juncture is just a deal between the United States and Mexico. And I would note that the president of Mexico in that phone call that occurred in the, in the Oval Office with the president on one end, that he really wasn't referring to this as a deal, more like an understanding. It's going to be some months, and it faces legislative hurdles both in Washington and Mexico City. So there could be a number of tweaks to this before it does go into effect, if it does at all.
Right. You mentioned the legislative hurdles because Congress authorized the president to renegotiate NAFTA, which this is not. The president has a proclivity to like to pursue bilateral trade agreements, and this one is only with Mexico, which leaves Canada the odd person out. What has Canada said about the announcement that was made today?
Canada will be continuing negotiations in Washington this week. The Foreign Minister of Canada will be here from Tuesday, and there are very wide expectations that by Friday that there will be some sort of announcement that Canada has also reached a preliminary agreement. And there's a perception of what was announced today was, in a sense, a way to pressure Canada to say, hey, look, you know, United States and Mexico, we've put something down on paper here, and we're going to go ahead without you unless you also are able to agree to something. Now, again, the Mexicans are being a bit more hesitant about it. They are saying, yes, this could go ahead without Canada, but they have full expectations and full hopes that this will essentially be a three-way deal just like NAFTA. And as you point out, there are some difficulties there that if this were to go ahead as a bilateral deal and you still have NAFTA hanging out there, how does that all work? But the president made it clear today that he would kill off NAFTA with or without Canada in some sort of new agreement.
You also mentioned just a moment ago that perhaps this is some kind of leverage tool to be used in negotiations with Canada. But Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto is due to leave office in just a few months, December 1st. Is this also being used as a tool to try and get one last thing done before he goes out of office?
Well, certainly the president of Mexico wanted to leave some sort of a positive legacy in the trade arena, and this would be it. The incoming president of Mexico is much more left-leaning. The initial indications we have from him is that, in general, he's satisfied with what has been worked out, and his people were in on these negotiations. That was a very prudent decision that was made by both the United States and Mexico, realizing that Peña Nieto is a lame duck, and it would be prudent to have some people from the next administration essentially signing off on this if they wanted to have any hopes of flying with the Mexican legislature and being supported by the new administration.
That was VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman on the phone with us. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Steve.
Tributes and remembrances of the life of Senator John McCain continue to pour in as the United States prepares for a week of commemorations in three cities. Rick Davis, McCain's former presidential campaign manager, announced the plans on Monday in Phoenix during a press conference carried by KNXV-TV.
The first event will be here at the state capitol, the old capitol, and it'll be a kind of formal political event. It will be, I think, the main significance of it is, if you needed to be told this, it will be on John's 82nd birthday. Only John McCain could rig a big birthday celebration for himself like this.
According to the plans, 2 days later, McCain will lie in state at the U.S. Capitol Rotunda in Washington, where he made his legislative mark as an outspoken maverick Republican senator for 32 years. After a memorial service Saturday at the Washington National Cathedral, with eulogies by former Presidents Barack Obama and George W. Bush, McCain will be buried Sunday at his college alma mater, the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland. After McCain's death, U.S. President Donald Trump tweeted, "My deepest sympathies and respect go out to the family of Senator John McCain. Our hearts and prayers are with you." After the Saturday death of McCain, the White House flag was lowered to half-staff and returned to full height on Monday, provoking consternation and confusion. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani has that story from the White House.
The president had said nothing about McCain and today refused several times to answer questions. He's now issued a written statement saying he respects McCain's service to our country and has signed a proclamation ordering that the U.S. flag fly at half staff until McCain's buried this weekend. The flag here at the White House was at half staff yesterday before being raised this morning and has again been lowered amid withering criticism. The president says he's agreed to the McCain family's request to have the military transport his remains from Arizona to Washington. Sagar Magani at the White House.
The president did express his condolences while attending an event Monday evening celebrating evangelical leadership.
Our hearts and prayers are going to the family of Senator John McCain. Going to be a lot of activity over the next number of days, and we very much appreciate everything that Senator McCain has done for our country. So thank you very much.
World leaders and McCain's former colleagues in Congress, Republicans and Democrats alike, have shared their favorite memories of McCain this week and extolled his status as a senior statesman on the world stage. They have remembered his military service as a naval aviator, especially his valor in enduring beatings and torture during 5.5 years as a prisoner of war at the hands of North Vietnamese captors at the height of the Vietnam War in the 1960s. Democratic Florida Senator Bill Nelson says his late colleague John McCain knew about public service.
He believed that a public office is a public trust, and he lived that in his daily life. And that's a voice that has now been stilled that I really wish we still had.
And New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, who was in the Clinton administration during part of Senator McCain's time in office, says the senator was honorable.
In many ways, he represented an older era of elected officials who could disagree and could fight and could fight passionately, but could do it with honor.
McCain died on Saturday after a lengthy battle with brain cancer. He was 81.
Among other top stories, the Chinese government formally requested dispute consultations with the United States over the Trump administration's imposition of $16 billion in tariffs on Chinese goods last week. Iran warned Monday that reimposed U.S. sanctions would cripple its economy and plunge the volatile Middle East deeper into crisis, as it urged the United Nations' highest court to suspend the Trump administration's economic pressure on Tehran. Japan said on Tuesday that North Korea still posed a dire threat to its security despite a halt to ballistic missile tests and a pledge by leader Kim Jong-un to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are at voanews.com and on the VOA mobile app. This is International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
According to the recently released State of the Climate Report, annual average air temperatures in the Arctic are increasing at twice the rate than the rest of the world. Researchers at the University of California, Berkeley, and Berkeley Labs have released a new study that indicates that with increasing Arctic temperatures, vegetation growth is booming in areas that were once thought too frigid to support plant life. The study shows that 16% of Arctic land, where it was once too cold for plant growth in 1982, now sustains vegetation. Study first author Trevor Keenan from Berkeley Labs says that while augmented vegetation growth, with its increased ability to absorb carbon dioxide, may sound like good news, it represents a major disruption to the delicate balance of the cold ecosystem. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. Investigators working for the United Nations' top human rights body said on Monday that Myanmar's military leaders should be prosecuted for genocide against Rohingya Muslims. VOA's Miller Sega has that story.
The three-member fact-finding mission and their team worked under a mandate from the UN-backed Human Rights Council. They meticulously assembled hundreds of accounts from expatriate Rohingya, as well as satellite footage and other information to assemble the report. Christopher Sadati is a member of that independent international fact-finding mission. He explained why the team identified six individuals by name among those behind deadly systematic crimes against the ethnic minority.
In the case of Myanmar, like almost all circumstances of genocide, there is no smoking gun. We do not have a copy of a direct order that says, undertake genocide tomorrow, please. But that is the case, you know, almost universally. When cases of genocide have gone before the courts, the intent has to be inferred from the surrounding circumstances. The two relevant things for us are, first, that the kinds of circumstances are of a nature, the kinds of circumstances that in other cases have been found to constitute or enable the inference of intent to be found. And second, in Myanmar, there is a very clear chain of command. And there is no doubt in our minds whatsoever that what we saw happen in Rakhine as a whole would not have happened without it firstly being within the knowledge of the senior military leadership and secondly under their effective control. And it's because of the clarity of the chain of command in Myanmar that we have recommended the investigation and prosecution of these six. We are not removing the presumption of innocence. We are not saying that they individually have been proven to have the necessary intent, but we are saying that given all of the circumstances, all of the inference, all of the facts that we have found, and we have found extensive range of facts, and the tightness of the chain of military command, They should be investigated and prosecuted.
Yangon-based analyst David Matheson says he didn't think the state councillor Aung San Suu Kyi would do anything meaningful in response to the report.
Unfortunately, I can't see that with her current behaviour, she will do anything meaningful about the fact-finding mission. She made it clear from early on that she was not going to cooperate with them. And I don't see that the initial release of the report's findings and recommendations right now is going to change her mind at all.
The Human Rights Council created the mission in March last year, nearly 6 months before a string of deadly rebel attacks on security and police posts set off a crackdown that drove Rohingya to flee into neighboring Bangladesh. The UN estimates that more than 700,000 have fled. The team compiled accounts of crimes including gang rape, the torching of hundreds of villages, enslavement, the killings of children, some before the eyes of their own parents. The team's chair, Marzuki Darusman, said they were not granted access to Myanmar and has decried a lack of cooperation or even response from the government, which received an early copy of the report.
When we said that we didn't receive any cooperation from the Myanmar government, this was in terms of being given access to the country. Now, informally, there was a reaching out of sorts by the government of Myanmar. We were contacted by envoys that were sent out by the state councillor to discuss and to present their version of the story, the issues. There were several meetings of that nature, but nothing of substance came out of these meetings.
David Matheson called it a bad day for Myanmar's military.
Because of the fact-finding mission, and also I think because Facebook has taken this incredibly strong action by actually taking down the Commander-in-Chief's page and 19 or so others. And I think this forces them into an isolation that they're not going to like. They're going to have to find alternative ways to communicate with the Myanmar population now, because Facebook really is the internet for many people here. And Facebook just excommunicated the Commander-in-Chief from the World Wide Web. Even though there are many other avenues for him to communicate, he was very, very fond of his Facebook page. So this is, I think, going to be remembered as a very bad day for the Tatmadaw.
The United States and the European Union have already slapped sanctions on some of Myanmar's military leaders. They also faulted Aung San Suu Kyi for not using her role as head of Myanmar's government, nor her moral authority. She is a Nobel Peace Prize laureate, to stop the events in embattled Rakhine State. Millar Sega, VOA News.
The campaign to ban killer robots is urging the United Nations to begin talks on legally binding treaties to ban the use and development of lethal autonomous weapon systems. Representatives from more than 70 countries are attending a week-long meeting on the Convention on Conventional Weapons, or CCW, to recommend future work on this issue. Lisa Schlein reports from the conference site in Geneva.
The campaign to ban killer robots is a global coalition of 76 organizations in 32 countries. Members include Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, Mines Action Canada, the Nobel Women's Initiative, and others. It began April 2013 to preemptively ban lethal autonomous weapon systems, better known as killer robots. Activists say momentum is building rapidly for states to start negotiating a ban on the devices when the CCW holds its annual meeting in late November. But the recommendation for this to go forward must be taken during this crucial meeting of experts. Since the last meeting in April, the campaign to ban killer robots reports 26 countries have joined the call for a ban. It says China is agreeable to a partial ban on the use of these weapons, though not on their development, and Russia has announced its support for a non-binding agreement. Mary Wareham of Human Rights Watch and coordinator of the campaign says this is putting pressure on the United States and other countries to support a ban on fully autonomous weapons.
So all of the ingredients are there for the states to take action now It's just a matter of who's willing to be the bad guy and try and block this. And that was what we'll know at the end of the week. The CCW operates by consensus, and it's always an awkward thing to witness. We'll find out on Friday if any country wants to block the consensus for the proposed mandate.
The proposed mandate is to negotiate a legally binding agreement by the end of 2019. During the last meeting, France, Israel, Russia, Britain, and the United States emerged as potential spoilers. All explicitly rejected moves to prohibit these weapons systems. Activists say legally binding arrangements must be enacted to ensure human control over lethal, fully autonomous weapons. To do otherwise, they say, would violate international ethical standards. They say it is not possible to hold killer robots accountable for acts that would amount to war crimes if triggered by a human. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And this is International Edition.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, pressure mounts on Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni over the beating and detention of music star Bobby Wine. And we'll discuss the legacy of Kofi Annan on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Come celebrate the 60th birthday of legendary King of Pop, Michael Jackson, on Wednesday, August 29th, with a very special edition of Border Crossings. Join Larry London as he takes you back through time with a full hour of Michael Jackson's greatest hits. With a career spanning over 40 years, Michael Jackson gave us plenty of songs to choose from. Don't miss Border Crossings on Wednesday, August 29th at 1500 Universal, as we pay tribute to one of the greatest pop stars of all time.
From the Voice of America, this is International Edition. Now, when visiting a city as a tourist, chances are you won't be bringing your own car along, so you're going to have to rely on some sort of public transportation, be that a bus, a subway, train, or a taxi. And it's that last form of transportation that Japan happens to be working on right now. Reuters' Michelle Hennessy reports Japan is testing an automatic taxi, which it hopes will ease pressure on the already stressed industry ahead of the 2020 Olympics.
This family in Japan is about to have the ride of their life, except they won't be driving themselves, and neither is their chauffeur. They're traveling in a robot taxi.
It was just like a normal taxi. Just sitting there, I would have forgotten it was an automatic. The car itself looks just like a normal one.
The model is being created by robotics developer ZMP, which has been working with Japanese taxi firm Hinomaru.
We wanted to help those who don't have transportation. We want people without access to public transportation to have easier access. So this was the idea behind our vision for the automatic taxi.
The company's aim is to get the automatic taxis on the streets of Tokyo by the start of the 2020 Olympics. The city's taxi industry is already stressed, with unprecedented levels of tourism and an aging population. The average age of Tokyo's taxi drivers is almost 60, and there's a shortage of suitable drivers, according to Hinomaru. Robot taxis could help solve that issue, but it's not without its faults. The three-mile test drive was not completely automatic, and still needed a driver in some parts of the route to control the wheel.
That was Reuters reporter Michelle Hennessy. Taking a low dose of aspirin every day has been known to help people who have already had a heart attack. But major new research has found the risks do not outweigh the benefits for most other people. VOA's Faith Lapidus has the details.
While aspirin is what many people reach for to relieve headaches and muscle pain, doctors like cardiologist Holly Anderson have long recommended taking a daily low-dose aspirin for preventing a heart attack, stroke, or other heart problems in people who have already had one.
It's clear that people who have had heart attacks or most strokes can benefit from taking a baby aspirin every day. It's very important. It reduces your future risk of stroke, heart attack, and can make you live longer.
Now, major research has tested whether aspirin can help prevent first-time heart problems. And the results of three separate studies indicate no. One study looked at more than 12,000 patients at moderate risk of a heart problem because of other health issues like high blood pressure, high cholesterol, or smoking. The results showed no benefit. Dr. J. Michael Gaziano of Brigham and Women's Hospital suggests that might be because they were taking other medications that lowered the risk anyway.
The risk that a person has changes over time, and some of that change is due to some of the things that we do, like managing their risk factors and then taking care of them when they develop symptoms.
Dr. Jane Armitage of the University of Oxford led another study of more than 15,000 adults with diabetes that found the good aspirin did was outweighed by a greater risk of serious bleeding.
We also saw almost a 30% increased risk in major bleeding. So that was bleeding bad enough to get you into hospital, mainly from the gut, or bleeding into the eye or brain. And if it was into the eye, it was bad enough to threaten your sight.
Based on these studies, revealed this weekend at the European Society of Cardiology, the advice does not change. Doctors say aspirin best benefits people who already have heart disease. Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
And before I go, on this day back in 1609, English sea explorer Henry Hudson and his ship, the Half Moon, reached present-day Delaware Bay. And in 1963, more than 200,000 people listened as the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. delivered his I Have a Dream speech in front of the Lincoln Memorial in Washington. That's going to do it for me today on International Edition. Tracy Carter directed the program, and John Allison engineered the broadcast. I'd also like to thank you for taking time out of your day for joining us. Now, to keep up with the latest pictures, videos, stories, and more, be sure to follow the Voice of America on YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a terrific Tuesday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The overarching strategy of the United States towards Russia is to deter Russia from confrontation by raising the costs of its aggression. This includes strengthening the military, economic, and political foundations of American power. Our Russia policy proceeds from the recognition that to be effective, U.S. diplomacy must be backed by military power, said Assistant Secretary for European and Eurasian Affairs Wes Mitchell in congressional testimony. To that end, we have reversed years of cuts to the defense budget, begun the process of recapitalizing the U.S. nuclear arsenal, requested close to $11 billion for the European Deterrence Initiative, and worked within NATO to bring about more than $40 billion in new European defense spending. Through diplomatic expulsions and targeted sanctions, the U.S. has worked in close coordination with European allies to degrade Russian President Vladimir Putin's ability to conduct aggression by imposing costs on the Russian state, as well as on the oligarchs close to Putin who helped to sustain the state. Even as the U.S. has imposed unprecedented penalties for Russian aggression, said Dr. Mitchell, we have been clear that the door to dialogue is open. In Syria, Dr. Mitchell said, we created de-escalation channels to avoid collisions between our forces. In Ukraine, we have maintained an effort under Ambassador Kurt Volker to provide the means by which Russia can live up to its commitments under the Minsk agreements. But in all these areas, it is up to Russia to take the next step. The U.S. has bolstered frontline states in Europe. In Ukraine and Georgia, said Assistant Secretary Mitchell, we lifted restrictions on the acquisition of defensive weapons. In the Balkans, we have played a hands-on role in resolving the Greece-Macedonia name dispute and engaging with Serbia and Kosovo to propel the EU-led dialogue. From the Caucasus to Central Europe, we are promoting energy diversification, fighting corruption, and competing for hearts and minds. Russia foments and funds both sides of controversial causes in an effort to destabilize societies and governments. Countering such threats in both its overt and covert forms is among the highest priorities of the U.S. government and our NATO allies. The United States is committed to countering Russian aggression and malign activities. At the same time, the door to dialogue is open. Our respective national security advisors have met in Geneva. Should Russia choose to take steps toward a constructive path.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.